Welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Katie Halper.
Actually, I'm Steve Hansen this week for the Halloween edition of Useful Idiots.
Well, I'm post-study abroad student.
Post-study abroad student. So what is that you're wearing on your head?
A scarf. I think it's a Tibetan scarf, I think. And then I don't actually know where this scarf is from. And then I just put together two earrings. I wasn't as prepared as Matt. I certainly didn't buy any costume, but I thought this was pretty resourceful.
Well, I didn't buy any costume either. I just have this.
Well, you bought it at one point.
At one point I bought it, but that's not because I was planning on wearing
it. Wasn't for Halloween.
Wasn't for Halloween. I just buy weird costumes all the time.
Oh, right. You do. Yeah. What else do you have? You should do a fashion show at some point.
I mean, I've got a whole Sherlock Holmes thing. I've got a gorilla suit. I've got a Viking costume. I've got a couple of sort of werewolf type things.
Interesting. This kind of has a werewolf feel to it.
Yeah. I've got some things from movies, like, you know, the jacket that Roy wore in Blade Runner.
Oh, wow.
Oh, you're taking that off already.
Well, I have an alternate. Hold on. I have alternate costume.
Oh, nice. Very good. Oh, yeah. Yeah, look at that.
Although I think this is a Ukrainian outfit, not Russian, but...
Could be.
It's my voodoo deal. I put pins in little Ukrainian girl because anime.
Ah, little kukla. Interesting.
Yeah. Kukla, that's in Greek too. It means doll.
Yeah, kuklas.
Kukla moo is my little doll. I know that, but interesting. Yeah. I wonder who came up with that word first, the Greeks or the Russians. I'm sure we could call some ethnic genocide if we put that question out publicly.
There was a very popular show when I was there called Kukli, which was based on the British puppet show.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they had sort of political satire, but yeah. So this wig is really hot. I'm going to wear it for as long as I can before
you melt.
Before we might have to make an abrupt costume change. So a lot of stuff happened this week.
So much stuff.
Was any of it interesting?
Oh yeah. I mean, we have some bad news. We got Steven Donziger, friend of show, he wanted to be out on bail until they ruled on his appeal, and that was denied. So he is reporting to prison. October 27th, reporting to prison. Really ridiculous.
He got 6 months, right?
He got 6 months, and he has to start serving it now, even though really he should be able to wait until the actual appeal is ruled on. I don't know if we talked about this. Did we talk about it? But the judge who sentenced him actually said, it seems only being hit in the between the eyes with the proverbial 2x4 will instill in him a respect for the law.
Yeah.
Who says that?
Judges. Judges say all kinds of crazy shit.
Judges who work for who are on the board or part of the Federalist Society, which receives funding from Chevron.
Yeah. And just, although I hate to push back in this case, but it's not exactly atypical for somebody to not be allowed to remain out on bail pending appeal.
Right.
Like that happens pretty often in everyday criminal cases. Right. It happens a lot less often in white collar cases, but no, it's definitely not good news.
Yeah. And by the time this was released, who knows what's going to happen with Assange? There's going to be, I don't know. I mean, right now there's a hearing, right? They're appealing the ruling on the extradition because the judge said he shouldn't be extradited. Mm-hmm. And now they're appealing it.
Right.
He's also been locked up, even though he won his extradition case.
Yeah. I mean, Julian Assange is never getting out. I mean, I'm
so depressed.
I don't mean to be
a downer.
They'll be downer about this, but you know, if he does get out, he's going to have a very dramatic accident the moment he steps out of the prison. You know what I mean? But lots of other stuff. Facebook is in the news about, you know, a lot of stuff we talked with Evan about last week.
Probably because we covered it.
Yeah, because we covered it. It's gotten to the point where it's a little weird. Havana syndrome, amazingly, it's back in the news.
Tell us about that. What is Havana syndrome, Matt? Do you suffer from it?
I do not suffer from Havana syndrome, although you might infer from my appearance that something is wrong with me. Yeah, Havana syndrome was a story that started during early in the Trump years that a bunch of people in and around the embassy, U.S. embassy in Cuba, came down with neurological symptoms. You're laughing. What are you laughing at?
Because it's so not plausible.
Right. So these people came down with neurological symptoms. Of course, the immediate conclusion that one comes to is Russia's using a secret sonic microwave weapon to aim at the brains of American diplomats and others. And now we've seen cases like this sort of replicated around the world. While some people think that this is a mass psychogenic episode and has all the classic hallmarks of this, the CIA is apparently moving forward with an alternative theory that this is a sophisticated assault, so sophisticated that the most advanced military in the world can't recognize this weapon. They're sort of pushing for actual response. And I don't know what response would be appropriate for trying to melt the brains of people in embassies around the world other than war. So it gets...
Nuke them. You can nuke them with nukes, or you can nuke them in a microwave. Just put their heads in microwaves.
Right. Yes, exactly. Like a bunch of ramen noodle.
Yeah. Ramen heads.
Ramen brains. Yeah, exactly. So that happened.
What is psychogenic? What did you say? That some people think it's a psychogenic...
Well, we can't say hysteria anymore, remember?
Because uterus. So,
exactly. So the term used to be mass hysteria.
Right.
The new term is mass psychogenic illness.
Mass psychogenic illness. Got it. Mm-hmm. MPI.
But according to Politico, it's not that. So, and some others and some CIA spokespeople. So
spooks people.
Yeah, exactly.
For Halloween.
So that's pretty weird, because you know that's the thing about that story is they killed it like 9 times. Like there were, you know, there was an episode where they had experts listening to what they thought was noise from the weapon, and they came back with the conclusion that those were actually cicadas. And there was another one where, you know, another group of doctors said, well, this feels like a psychogenic episode to me, and they just kept, you know, piling on. But it lives. So that happened. And I don't know. Should we just move on to... We have a great guest today.
Yeah, we do.
Regular friend of the show who's going to be introducing a series that on a subject that I'm pretty familiar with. In fact, I was quasi-involved in this whole thing. But we'll let that be a surprise.
Yeah, we'll let that be a surprise.
So, all right. So I guess we should move to... doing the four food groups. I'm going to take off this wig, which is like burning my head.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, okay. Yeah, do it. Yeah.
Four, Democrats suck, which is one of our four food groups. I figured, like, Wilson, if we could just look at the Washington Post story about additional Medicare and Medicaid benefits maybe whittled or cut as Democrats woo moderates. Hate to say I told you so, but this is, again, part of the ongoing negotiations over the reconciliation bill, and I'm just going to read from the lead of the story. Democrats' sweeping plans to bolster Medicare and Medicaid benefits have been scaled back amid an assault from industry groups and opposition from centrists like Senator Joe Manchin III, with popular coverage expansions likely to be narrowed in hopes of reaching a deal this week. A proposal to expand Medicare to cover dental, hearing, and vision benefits is in danger of falling from the tax and spending package rapidly taking shape in Congress. A framework to expand Medicaid to cover Americans in a dozen mostly southern states has also been reworked. Meanwhile, liberals plan to give Medicare broad power to negotiate prescription drug prices has come under sustained attack from pharmaceutical lobbyists and some Democrats, including Kyrsten Sinema. Scaling back that proposal, which is expected to save more than $700 billion over a decade, also complicates Democrats' efforts to pay for coverage expansions. Not to be a jerk about this, but when we first started talking about this bill, I said, I just do not believe that they're ever going to really pass this. I don't believe it's just Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema who don't want this stuff. I think they've never wanted this stuff. Like, again, go back
to rotating villain.
Right. Like, we could go back to Barack Obama's 2008 campaign when he He promised the exact same stuff. Like, let's have bulk negotiation of Medicare prices, drug prices for Medicare. Like, oh, we definitely need that. It's ridiculous. You know, the VA already does it. Why can't we, you know, why can't we do it with Medicare? Then he gets in office, and within like a week, he's having meetings with the heads of pharma. And then within a couple of months, they have a deal to go through with Obamacare that leaves out that and like 19 other things that they never really wanted, right? So sort of in that vein, Wilson, if we could also just see Nancy Pelosi talking a couple of weeks ago, because this was sort of a precursor.
I did tell you that, didn't I?
No, I don't think you did, actually. I think you said...
Well, you asked me and you forgot. You said, are you going to do it in reconciliation? And I said, no.
Well, it's only extended for about a month.
Maybe I didn't recognize you with the mask. I'm optimistic that these decisions have to be made. There's been a lot of discussion, and we are a Democratic Party. We are not a rubber stamp or a lockstep party. We have our discussions, and I'm very proud of the values that all the members have brought to the table, the knowledge of the issues that they're advancing, that they bring, and the realization that even at 3.5, you have to make decisions. So again, we have to make tighter decisions. Now, my last letter previous to this one, I said, everybody sharpen your pencil. I mean, it's an old phrase. Nobody uses a pencil anymore, I guess, but sharpen your pencil.
So they've been signaling all along that
in any other way,
they're going to be doing some cuts. And, you know, we're just sort of working this out. We have to listen to everybody. We're a Democratic Party. We got to, you know, we're not in lockstep about anything. And so, again, I'm just going to hold to my prediction that in the end, what we're basically going to get is the infrastructure bill with a couple of cosmetic things attached to it. And all of this stuff is going to have served mainly to create the impression that they desperately wanted something, but were held back by these two villains,
right,
you know, who just could not be convinced to go along. Of course, in reality, again, to reiterate a point, if there were really only two of them, you know, they would
be able to overcome it.
Yeah, they would put Manchin's nuts in a vise somehow and get his signature on this thing. Which is what the Bush administration did, you know, over and over and over again when they wanted to pass something. It didn't matter what it was, like CAFTA, for instance, right? They would have four holdouts in the House, and Tom DeLay would take them all into a back room, and they would come out, you know, with bruises around their eyes and, you know, pledging that they suddenly have had a change of heart about the bill. You know, this is what happens when you're in Congress. They have a big hammer, which is,
right,
yeah, you want all those jobs in your district, or you want this or that. Like, you're going to have to play ball on this thing.
They'd come out looking like the Hansen brothers had roughed them over.
Exactly. You sit in the penalty box and you feel shame afterwards. That's from the line from the movie, too. So I don't know. I don't know what you think about this, but I'd love to hear your thoughts, because it feels to me like they've run a big game on Bernie in particular again, and they added a little insult to injury with putting Neera Tanden in the White House staff.
Yeah, we said, you said, and I agreed that it was the rotating villain phenomenon. I think maybe there's value in showing that there's, I don't know, that people are willing to fight for it, but maybe they're not. What does that mean? I mean, at least will it put them on, it'll put them on blast, I guess, only if they make it so that it's not just these two exceptional villains.
Yeah, but again.
But they're not going to.
They're not going to. Like, no matter, I just don't buy it. Like, unless they have a change of heart and they recognize the truth, which is that if they don't come up with something that has pretty dramatic real world impact on the lives of ordinary people, they're, you know, they're going to be in real trouble in 2022 and then in even worse trouble in 2024, because they just can't bring themselves to come to this realization that they got to deliver somewhere.
Right.
You know, like you can't just talk about this stuff or complain about how crazy the Republicans are. It doesn't really work that way.
Because they don't actually want to deliver. And so, yeah, this is great. They get to play make-believe.
Right.
This or is... not make-believe. They get to play, we wish we could do this, but we can't, unfortunately.
Yeah, which would work if they hadn't done it 59 times already. I had to give a speech earlier this week where I was talking about like some of the changes in the electorate in the last 20 years or so. And I mentioned this couple that I interviewed in Iowa. You know, they were Democrats. They had lost their jobs. One of them had lost her job to somebody who was on an H-1B visa. So she had a high-tech job. She worked in a financial services company in Iowa. She got laid off. She got cancer, then got laid off. And the company hired somebody on an H-1B visa in India at like 1/20th the cost of of her job. When she complained about, or she asked Amy Klobuchar a question about this in an event, Klobuchar's response was, well, "What is, you're against the path to citizenship?" Completely conflating two issues. One, H-1B, it's not an immigration issue, right? But she's like essentially white woke washing the whole thing, like.
Right.
You know, what are you against immigrants? Are you're a xenophobe? You're a racist like Trump? And the you know, these people talked to me afterwards and they said, we've been asking about this issue for five consecutive election cycles. We can tell you about John Kerry's exact answer that's just like that and all the Democrats in between. And at some point they reach a level of just disbelief. You know, how many times can you hear the same answer and the same promises on things? It would be great if they were to negotiate, you know, bulk negotiate drug prices for Medicare, because people really can't afford their drug, you know, their medicines right now. That would be a big thing. It would be appropriate. Even if you're a hardcore capitalist, it would be appropriate.
Right.
Just but they won't do it.
Survival.
Yeah.
Just for the sake of placating the masses.
Right. They just can't. They can't even take that step or ending the carry interest tax break or any of a dozen other things that are just obvious. You know.
So what do you think is going to happen?
I really think that they are convinced that some combination of keeping the public focused on how nuts Donald Trump is and how crazy some of, you know, the Republican proposals are, that'll be enough to get people to come out and vote. But
you think it'll work?
Well, it worked in the last election cycle. You can't say it's a complete fantasy, but would they have won that election if it hadn't been for COVID
and Trump's mishandling of it and getting it? Yeah.
And they did well in the last midterms, but so who knows? I don't think they've gotten the memo on this yet. I they're not ready to.
Or maybe they would just rather lose and not cave to people, what people actually want. So maybe it's not that they haven't gotten the memo.
Right. Well, they don't really want to win.
Right.
They're happy being the earnest opposition that tries as hard as it can, but whatever reason just can't seem to get over. And we're going to talk about some of this with our guests, by the way, because
perfect timing.
There's some of these issues came up. But yeah, I just don't think that they're not really grappling with the whole question of like, how do we govern better? They're still convinced that this is a political issue, that they can fix it with politics and not with policy, right? Like there's a great line in a play that Joseph Heller wrote called We Bombed in New Haven. He's the guy who wrote Catch-22.
Right.
And he once said, there's an exchange where these two characters are saying, well, we're going to bomb Constantinople right off the map. And the other one says, well, why don't we just bomb the map? All right. And that's what they're doing. They keep trying to bomb the map rather than actually doing something, you know? So anyway, that's
why is it called We Bombed New Haven?
We bombed in New Haven.
Why is it called that?
Well, it's a play on an old sort of theater complaint. I think it used to be either we bombed in Peoria, we bombed in Binghamton. I forget why New Haven is somehow figures into the story.
Okay.
But you know, the old days before you got to Broadway, you bombed somewhere else.
Right.
Will it play in Peoria or, you know, maybe something along those lines. There's a play on that. if I remember correctly.
A play.
A play on that. Yeah.
Get it.
Anyway, that's my Democrats suck. I should have picked Neera, but you know, I'll leave her to you at some point. So
we should have a Neera segment.
What do we have for Republicans suck?
So for Republicans suck, we have a good friend of the show, Rep. Madison Cawthorn. I think we should just show the video.
Madam Speaker, Dr. Fauci has forsaken his Hippocratic Oath and exchanged it for the mantle of unchecked power. His policies shuttered the U.S. economy, drove our country into financial upheaval, and violated the rights of millions of Americans. In July, he willfully lied to the U.S. Senate about his role in funding gain-of-function research in Wuhan, China. This week, the world was shocked to discover that through an experiment under his watch, sweet beagle puppies had their heads stuffed into crates so that sand flies could slowly strip away the skin from their bones. These defenseless animals were damned to agonize in silence because their vocal cords had been surgically ripped from their throats so that their tormentors could discharge their evil actions without having to hear incessant yapping. Madam Speaker, today I am calling for the creation of a formal commission to investigate the true origin of COVID-19, the role Fauci played in its creation, the false statements he made to members of Congress under oath, and why the hell Americans are funding the torture of puppies in Africa. Americans deserve the truth, and this demon doctor must never be allowed to escape justice. With that, I yield back.
So the main line I like there is the demon doctor must never be allowed to escape justice.
Oh, he said escape? I didn't even hear that.
Yeah.
Can we hear that again?
And this demon doctor must never be allowed to escape justice.
Escape. That's good.
Yeah. That's a band, right?
Escape?
I think so, yeah.
Is it?
Or maybe it's just escape.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, I just like the demon doctor line.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's almost Republicans are awesome. Reminds me of when you didn't know whether Sean Spicer should be Republicans suck or Republicans are awesome after he took part in Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah, that was impressive. I think in hindsight.
Yeah.
That was clearly awesome. The Fauci thing is, I don't know.
I'm not pro. I certainly don't think he's a saint. Have you seen? This is almost like more of a Democrat suck, honestly. What I think is interesting is that one man's saint is another man's demon.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it is ridiculous, the sainthood of the sanctity of Fauci. They have candles.
Well, this has been a recurring theme of the last 5 years, this whole let's make saints out of people. You know, whether it was Mueller, right? We had votive candles to Mueller.
Oh, really? I didn't know there were Mueller candles.
Oh, you didn't?
Mm-mm.
Oh, my goodness. There's a massive assortment of Mueller votive candles.
And there's a Disney, what channel is the Fauci movie on? Let's see. Yeah, it's Disney, which is so funny.
Again, this is a recurring theme of just the way we cover everything in the last 5 years. We have saints and sinners, you know, people become instantaneously fault free, basically unimpugnable, right? So Fauci is a great example. Mueller is another example. It's a little bit different, but there was clearly like a canonization of George Floyd that went on in the press. And
well, yeah, they said that he died for our sins, basically. Nancy Pelosi said that he was sacrificed. Yeah.
Right. They start using this language that's different from the way we talked about people previously in the,
It reminds me a little bit of the Cuomo thing.
Oh, yeah. Cuomo at the beginning of COVID.
Right. For Cuomo sexuals. But the Fauci thing is just like Fauci. Who was I talking about this with? Was it with you about how he looks so chill and happy all the time, despite the fact that there was a pandemic raging that he was giving kind of and again, I'm not vilifying him. I don't. Okay.
He's giving succor.
Yeah. Succor. Yeah. Hot take. Fauci, neither demon nor saint. Now, maybe this is because I'm not a religious person, so neither of those things really appeal to me. But I do think that he really was always, how was he always so chill? Shouldn't he have been more upset? I mean, I guess it's comforting, but he was giving one answer and then another. And I'm not vilifying him for that, because I think in science and medicine, you are constantly evolving your position based on the data.
Yeah.
So I don't think some people are like, oh, we can't listen to them, or oh, they're all liars, or what? You know, I don't think that that's inherently a problem, but it definitely was something that should not have inspired such a chillness in him. Although, what do you want? You don't want to see, it's not the chill factor. It's just like, he looks so relaxed and happy all the time. He doesn't ever look worried about anything.
Right.
And that reminds me of the Cuomo thing where he was just informed or claimed to be informed and was just basically not saying that you should inject your lungs with bleach. And because of that, and just reading information, he was seen as a hero.
The problem with that is that people have stopped applying the usual standard of
right.
Let's examine everything they say
and
decide whether it's true or not. Like, you know, basically they've moved to a new model of, well, let's give the benefit of the doubt to this person permanently because of whatever their status is in relation to a villain, right? So whether it's Christopher Steele or the anonymous whistleblower or the anonymous editorial writer at the New York Times or whoever it is, they become canonized, and it becomes impossible for anybody to ask any questions about anything.
And it was interesting to watch Comey and Mueller go from saint to demon, and then Comey came back around to saint again, right?
Kind of. I mean, he has a movie with, about him, right? Yeah, and Comey was vilified initially because of what his release of the emails thing, and then he came back into vogue as the great unimpeachable hero, and then there were questions raised again about him. But for the most part, we just followed this pattern of, well, this person is anti-Trump, so they can't be wrong about anything, which is just, we've gone over this territory so many times, but it's...
I don't like David Rubin at all, but he did show you what came in a... Can we watch this? The Fauci promo box?
All right, so what I was talking about here, I'm not making this thing up. I guess you weren't here for this yesterday. The Disney, which is a giant corporation... they've got a movie about this Fauci guy, and for some reason they sent us a box of Fauci stuff. Like, if you don't think this is all just packaged bullshit, I've got Fauci in a box, okay? So this is, I guess there's a documentary. It's in conjunction with National Geographic and Disney. It's like, you know what? If there was a freaking pandemic and they were really fearing that everybody's dying, do you think they'd be spending any of their money on their fancy box and let's see what's in this ridiculous box? They'd be putting it all to figuring out how to solve the thing. Oh, look at this. You can get a Fauci mask. That's great. Oh, and a little Fauci fanny pack. That's nice. And Fauci cards. I'm going to literally vomit. And Fauci chocolate, although this isn't branded Fauci. Oh, and Fauci popcorn. So they want you to have chocolate and popcorn because that way you can become fat and die of COVID. More popcorn. Fauci the book. Oh, right. Oh, my God. Oh. I mean, this is absolutely extraordinary. Fauci the fucking candy box. That's what they're giving you. Get me the numbers on overweight people dying of COVID. Fauci, you got your chocolate, you got your popcorn, you got your gummy bears and your Sour Patch Kids, and you can put it all in your fanny pack while you're sitting there, you fat freak. And then you can put your soda right here in the Fauci. Oh my God. And what's this here? Blissy? I don't even know what this is. Scrunchies. Scrunchy? Oh, a scrunchie. You can put Fauci a scrunchie in your hair too.
Wow.
There's no business like show business. There's no business.
Wait a minute.
I know.
Somebody made a Fauci scrunchie.
I would wear that.
You would wear a Fauci scrunchie?
Scrunchies are back.
They're back?
I guess so. I think they are kind of back in an ironic way. But yeah, I mean, okay, there are a couple things here. One is that this whole line, it's really annoying. This line that Ruben is pushing and a lot of other people are pushing, which is like, oh, who cares about the vaccine? People should be encouraged to eat healthily and not be overweight. Or as he says, you're going to get fat and die of COVID.
Well, okay.
Yes. Okay, yes, there's comorbidity, right? The more overweight you are, the less healthy you are. But it's a bit of a...
It is totally hypocritical how people who did not care about obesity suddenly care about obesity, right? Like, that's a thing.
Yeah, and it turns into this bootstrapping thing. It's like bootstrapping science denial. Vaccine denial, let's say. Vaccine dismissal.
I think there's a range of stuff going on the other side with this. On one side, you will see outright vaccine denialists who take any negative information about Fauci to be... See, they're lying about the vaccine.
Right.
And then there's another, I think, a level of this where it's just anger at people who, you know, at being lied to about stuff. No, I think there's a lot of people who are kind of on the right, conservatives who are kind of, you know, in a schadenfreude kind of way, looking at every disclosure that that Fauci is lying about something as just further evidence that we're being lied to about stuff. Right. And it just connects to everything else, right? So CNN saying that Joe Rogan took horse dewormer or whatever it was, you know, when he's got a human prescription for it, and refusing to correct that even after they've been, you know, called out for something like that. There's an element of that with this Fauci story that doesn't have anything to do with the vaccine. Then there's another level of people who are vaccine, you know, like deep into the vaccine conspiracy thing, you know, who are looking at revelations like this gain of function thing as just another brick in the wall that they're building that is going to eventually end up as a fully constructed conspiracy story, right? Like there was a lab leak and some combination of US and Chinese research led to this disaster. I don't know that everybody who's criticizing Fauci is a vaccine denialist. I think that's probably not
true. No, but I think this guy is.
I rarely feel comfortable talking about this subject in almost any way because it's got a lot of gradations to me. I obviously believe the vaccine because I've taken it. I'm looking forward to getting a booster because I'm nervous that it's been so long. On the other hand, I'm a little troubled by sort of the changing nature of the narrative about the vaccine, about its efficacy. I'm not entirely sure that the motives for vaccinating kids have been fully explained to me, like especially sort of under 12 kids. But I'm afraid to say that stuff because then people are going to come out and say right? Or another example is the people who've already had the disease and have natural immunity. Like,
yeah, my cousin was actually talking about that, which is that she was saying in Europe that they check your antibodies before giving you the vaccine. Mm-hmm. My cousin's a physician's assistant. She's vaccinated. And she was saying that she thinks that's what they should do here. Because you don't want, if you have the immunity, it does become an unnecessary vaccine.
Yeah,
she was saying you should keep checking it and then when the antibodies, I guess, wear off, then you should vaccinate.
Yeah, so it comes back to this sort of weird dichotomy where it's almost like it's deliberate that we can't have a civilized discussion about this. Right. Like, why is it impossible for a bunch of people to sit down in a room and say, okay, yeah, like there's lots of evidence the vaccine is really effective in preventing deaths. So let's yay that, right? But then let's look at each of these questions separately. Like, you know, should people who've already had the disease, do they need to be vaccinated? Do kids need to be vaccinated? What's the cost benefit analysis of that? Can we explain that to the public in a way that's non-alarmist? Well, in other words, can we at least talk about the subject without labeling anybody who asks a question about it as a vaccine denialist?
Right.
On the flip side, is it possible for people to look at any of these questions or any of these inconsistencies or any of these revelations about things that may or may not be particularly complimentary to someone like Fauci and not see that as evidence that the vaccine doesn't work. You know what I'm saying? I just feel like people are dug into these maximalist positions about these things.
Yeah. And I think that also people just don't trust. I think probably that there is, you know, sometimes I think leftists, vaccine believers, supporters, I would count myself among those. I got the vaccine. I think people should get the vaccine. Although I do think that it would be great if people's antibodies were taken into account before they got those. But I think that sometimes people like that are afraid to, well, you have two extremes, I think, like you're saying. There's another one, which are like the leftist critics of big pharma, of which I would count myself as well, but who use that as evidence that the vaccine is bad or doesn't work or shouldn't be taken. And I think that you can be critical of big pharma. I mean, I wonder if part of the reason that they're not, I'm torn between, and I don't know enough about this, so I'm not commenting authoritatively here, but I think the fact that they don't look at like the antibodies before deciding whether to give you the vaccine could be because of just general like laziness, and it's better, it's easier to err on the side of over vaccinating than under vaccinating. And then of course it could be because of the big pharma wanting to push the vaccine. But of course the issue with big pharma is that they're not giving it out to in developing nations. They're not letting them.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on with these issues. But
what Dave Rubin said, he got locked off of Twitter over it. I didn't realize this.
Did he really?
He tweeted out, in July, he tweeted out, they want a federal vaccine mandate for vaccines, which are clearly not working as promised just weeks ago. People are getting and transmitting COVID despite vax. Plus now they're prepping us for a booster shot. A sane society would take a pause. We do not live in a sane society. Okay, I don't think that taking a pause is the right idea, but I don't think you should get banned from Twitter over it either. They said that he was spreading misinformation. He's very, he's kind of an idiot, but he's also kind of clever because he covered his ass a bit by saying that the vaccine mandate, he said the vaccine are clearly not working as promised just weeks ago. So he didn't say they're not working.
But I think that's a legitimate thing to point out. Like,
yeah, I do too. Although people do overly, I mean, yes, you can still transmit it when you have it, as Fauci himself said, but still the more people get vaccinated, the less of the virus is around. But once you get it, you can transmit it, but there's less of the virus, the more people.
This is a complaint that I've had about how we do media now. Yeah, it's a completely new way of thinking about reporting. Like in the not too distant past, like 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you would report something and not worry about how people would take it. What you're worried about is that true or not? And what they're doing now is they're saying, well, if we tell people that our estimations about efficacy, about the efficacy of the vaccine has dropped, right? Or that it's dropped over time to a degree that we didn't anticipate, that our initial estimates were off, then that is going to give succor to vaccine denialists. So we don't want you to actually talk about that anymore. So let's not report that. Let's assume that people are too dumb to handle that news. And not only that, you know, let's drop a hammer on people who do say it and kick them off the internet and do stuff like that. Because what we're really interested in is this new version of the press, which is propagandistic, which is designed really focused on the behavior of the person getting the news rather than what's true and what isn't.
Right.
And you should be able to just believe that the vaccine works and handle the news that, you know, some things didn't turn out the way they expected, or it's got some issues, or the transmissibility is, you know, is not what they expected, or, you know, it still prevents death, but you can still transmit it. Like, you know, all those things, you should be able to say that.
Yeah. And chew gum at the same time.
Yeah. Or
say that and not get banned. Yeah.
Right. And then, and when you ban those people or when you make it very, very difficult, you raise the cost on bringing up these issues significantly, what you end up is this sort of like monolithic news corps, the press corps, that is just universally distrusted, which
right, not
makes
to mention
the problem
martyrizing. Is that the word? Martyring people.
Yeah, just let them say whatever. Like, as long as what they're saying is accurate,
right?
You know, don't give them a hard time for. I mean, even if what they're saying is not accurate, frankly, I think unless there's harm, you shouldn't intervene. But it's gotten to the point of being ridiculous at this point. The degree to which they're clamping down on people for talking about this, when again, a lot of these issues they're not settled either. Like, we don't know 100%, right. You know, I think we can have a fairly good guess that the vaccine at this point, we have a fairly good idea that it's not causing, you know, sort of mass medical problems, right, on a degree that would approach anything like what would happen to the people if they didn't take the vaccine. In other words, you're much more likely to develop some kind of very serious syndrome if you're not taking it than if you do take
it.
But that doesn't mean that we know 100% for sure everything about what's going on with this vaccine, whether it's better or worse than some other treatment, whether it needs to be tweaked a little bit.
Yeah.
Like,
I think we know it's better. It's the only preventative thing, right? Like, there's treatment and then there's prevention or mitigating it ahead of time, so that, as you said, people who have the vaccine survive COVID more.
People should be able to handle that and take in news that, well, for instance, the new Merck drug, right? The molnupiravir. Like, suddenly people are like rooting against it to work, you know? Or they're writing these negative articles like, well, be careful about reading an article that's happy about this development, because that might lead people to not have faith in the vaccine. Like, what the fuck? Like, that is crazy.
Yeah.
We should be happy. If it works, we should be happy. If it doesn't work, then we'll find that out.
Right. But people see it as like anti.
Right. They immediately see it as
anti-vaccine evidence. It's like competing with it. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is the lens that we look at every news story through which we look at every news story now. It's they're leaping ahead to some conclusion that's way off in the future. Yeah. Oh, you know, if we release news, and this goes back to the first time I started to see this was in the summer of 2016, when I started to hear reporters talking about, you know, the crowd sizes of Hillary Clinton's.
Right. Thing. And they inflated them.
Or they said, well, we shouldn't cover that,
cover
or
them.
we shouldn't talk about it because, and then they start stringing together consequences down the road. Like, people will take that as, you know, as evidence that there's something wrong with Hillary's campaign, which will somehow hurt her campaign. Another example that I had, I went to a Trump rally in an article that was severely negative about Trump. Like, you know, the title of the article was "The Fury and Failure of Donald Trump," it wrongly, by the way, predicted that Trump was dead. This was before the election. It was my last one I wrote before the election. Basically, said that his legacy was going to be the destruction of the Republican Party. I quoted some guy at a rally whose family had been union supporters their whole lives, had always thought that the Democrats are for the working man. Right. But they felt betrayed by NAFTA, and now he was voting for Trump. And I got all this blowback, both on social media and personally, like in emails and phone calls.
What happened to you?
People were like, well, now you're saying that economic insecurity is why people are voting for Trump. I'm like, no, I'm saying that I quoted one guy who, are we in a place where we can't give people sort of a variety of facts?
Yeah. Right. Also, that was a contribution to it. I mean, people think that if you say that, you're dismissing racism or you're exonerating Trump voters in some ways. But of course, if you care about elections, you should want to understand the various reasons that people vote for someone.
Of course.
Yeah. In fact, our guest today is going to talk about that.
Right. Our guest today is going to talk about, actually, the whole thing is about the way we didn't talk about this issue.
Right.
We were sort of systematically driven to not talk about this for a variety of reasons. But this is what happens when people grow up in a media environment where they're thinking about what behaviors am I inspiring with my coverage, rather than worrying about am I correct or not correct.
Right.
Like the latter is not really our job traditionally. It never has been. The former becomes devalued, and that's why we're having so many mistakes. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm on my high horse. No, that issue really pisses me off.
On your high horse paste?
In my high horse paste, yeah, exactly.
Afford Anything talks about how to avoid common pitfalls, how to refine your mental models, and how to think about how to think.
Paula, while certainly you can mess up on $1 million a year, it is far less likely than it is on $30,000 a year.
Right.
I would meet wonderful people that were struggling with a budget that was super tight. It was 100%. You need to make more money.
Make smarter choices and build a better life.
Afford Anything, wherever you listen.
All right. So isn't that weird? I think we got to go with this one. Wilson, if we can see the Washington Post story. So the headline here is a hiker got lost in Colorado, then ignored rescuers' calls because they came from an unknown number. This is already sort of hilariously terrible. So here's the lead. When a hiker who had ventured out to explore Mount Elbert, Colorado's highest peak, did not return by the end of the day as planned last week, a person who was worried about their safety called authorities to report them missing. First, emergency responders with the Lake County Search and Rescue Team in Leadville, about 100 miles southwest of Denver, called the hiker's cell phone, officials said. The call was declined. The rescue team kept trying, but repeated calls and texts to the hiker's phone went unanswered. So a team of at least eight launched a pair of hours-long searches, only to be notified the hiker had safely returned to their lodging location the next day. When Sacramento Bee first reported, the hiker who authorities, I think that's whom authorities have not identified, told rescuers they had no clue anyone had been searching for them. Their phone had been buzzing, the hiker said, but they repeatedly declined the calls.
Oh my God, that's so weird, by the way. Sorry. Literally,
why?
Right as you said that, I got a call, which I pressed decline on.
Not from an unknown number.
And I got to put on Do Not Disturb on my laptop. Sorry about that.
But they repeatedly declined the call since they were coming from an unknown number. So this is kind of awesome. I love this story because it's like, this is how crazy we are in America now. Like we may be dying, but we prioritize not being annoyed electronically over being rescued.
Yeah. That is kind of amazing. I kind of admire it.
I do too, a little bit. Part of me thinks it's also possibly the dumbest thing I've ever heard, but I can't tell.
Do you think they had like real trauma from one person in particular? Like
no.
Maybe they have an ex who keeps calling them from different numbers or something.
I feel like that would have been part of the story if that were the case.
Right.
If there was an excuse like that that made a little bit of sense, it feels a lot more like this is basically all of us who don't answer our numbers if we don't recognize them. Do you answer your number if you don't recognize them?
I do. I do sometimes. And then what I do is if they're scams, then I block their numbers.
Right.
Which I feel like not enough people do, kind of like not enough people drink coffee through a straw. To be fair, I'm drinking an iced coffee.
Right. Well, I would drink iced coffee.
Iced
coffee.
Yeah.
Hot coffee through a straw, though. That I can't
get a metal straw. That's what I'm supposed to do. My friend told me.
Doesn't do it.
Doesn't do it. Yeah.
Anyway, so that is weird. I think.
Yeah, right? That's weird. Yeah, it's kind of funny.
What do we have for Isn't That Terrible?
For Isn't That Terrible, we have something pretty, pretty, pretty terrible. Let's see. Wilson, could you open up that article about the poor man who had quite a shitty day,
so to speak?
A man was covered in poop after a passing plane dumped toilet waste over his backyard, lawmakers say. A man was enjoying the sun in his backyard in Windsor, Southeast England, when a passing plane dropped toilet waste over him and his garden furniture, a local councillor said during a recent meeting. The unfortunate incident in which a plane discharged sewage took place in July, according to the minutes of Royal Borough of Windsor and Maidenhead's most recent aviation form. His whole garden was splattered on in a very unpleasant way. My English accent is so great. So
no,
Karen Davies, thanks, ward councillor for Clewer East during the October 14th meeting. He was out in his garden at the time, and it was a really horrible experience. The local lawmaker continued. The whole garden, garden umbrellas and him were covered in poop, Davies explained. It's absolutely dreadful, she said during the meeting. What Davies said, by the way, is that, and I think you reported on this before, didn't you? Frozen sewage?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is, go ahead.
Well, this is not that rare, frozen sewage, but what made, and is this what you reported on? The Sun reported that Portsmouth in southern England, locals were terrified about frozen poo, which fell from the sky. That was back in June.
No, but, what I talked about was that the Book of Lists had a, I read as a kid. They had one of their lists was 27 things that fell from the sky or weird things that fell from the sky that included frozen sewage. But
wasn't it related to a story, a news story?
Maybe, yeah. I don't remember. Was, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's rarer to have raw sewage. And they think that maybe it was the summer's warmer weather. I mean, again, this is a good argument about why we should, good warning, cautionary tale about climate change and why we need to take it seriously. Because we don't take climate change seriously. Because the poop that's hitting
us is now not frozen.
Yeah, then melted. The shit is hitting the fan, so to speak. Or worse, it's hitting people.
Right.
Modern toilets on planes are vacuum secured and normally reliable as they rely on pressure suction to work. So this unfortunate situation must have resulted from aircraft failure or failure to adequately service it.
Well, that's troubling.
That's troubling. And what's really sad is that the Windsor resident was unable to claim any insurance from the ordeal as the cost of the damage was relatively low. But what about the PTSD of having raw sewage dropped on you? Shit splatter.
Yeah.
I feel like that.
Government should compensate.
The government somehow should compensate, yeah. Or maybe the plane company.
Yeah, you should get free flights forever.
Yeah, free flights forever. Unless maybe he's triggered and doesn't even want to go on a plane. Doesn't want to contribute to it. But no, I think
sure
that's
it
fair.
Was real poop?
I mean, I'm not going to victim blame. I'm not going to disbelieve him unless... I think that it's hard to confuse fresh sewage with something else.
Right.
What do you think it could be besides that?
I don't know. I'm sure I'm not the only one who did this, but there was a prank that I pretty regularly did on trains when I was growing up. I would sort of feign distress, you know, and as we're coming to the station in an Amtrak train, I would kind of stagger to the bathroom and in there, you know, make groaning noises, right? But then you open up a couple of Hershey bars and a lighter, you know, and then just smear the whole bathroom.
So awful.
Yeah, exactly. But just make it look like something exploded in there.
Right. But there's going to be an accompanying smell. I would submit.
That's true. But you, if you really want to sell it, you got to take a real dump as
but
you're
doing
it.
But I'm saying, I think I'm not encouraging you to, you know, to push, so to speak, to push it further. I'm just saying that I'm assuming that the guy smelled it.
Right. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Probably
so
true.
Awful. Reminds me of that terrible story about the woman who reached her hand into a burger and fries, but like one of the, I think the mom ate them and then the daughter, she must have had a less submerged portion of the fries. The mother.
Yeah. The shit fries story. We did have one of those, right?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. Over the summer. Actually, I remember it was in May.
Right. So that was from at Sam.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Thank you. Yeah. Shout out to the person who brought that to our attention. I just followed Sam Z and I doubled his following because I shouldn't out him. He had one follower, though. Now he has two. Maybe he can have three by the end. Wilson, can we get useful idiots to follow him for that contribution?
And that ended up being that debate where you and I kind of disagreed about whether or not pooping in a freezer would be.
That was different. Yes, that was different. Yeah, I still don't understand
that's still a
sore
thing.
Spot.
Yes, something between us that it's a sticking point in our relationship.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's introduce our guest.
Our guest is the journalist David Sirota,
longtime friend of show.
Runs a great website called Daily Poster. And he's now releasing a series that's available on Audible called Meltdown.
And Meltdown, which I should know this because I'm in it. The premise of this is that the response to the 2008 financial crisis set the foundation for Trump and was underreported. In other words, that it not only created economic conditions that left people in a state where they were angry enough to make a decision like that, but also that that we sort of systematically failed to recognize how bad that was, and how bad the optics of that whole episode were, which is something I can definitely sympathize with, because I felt, you know, for years covering this story, that a big part of the crash story that people really didn't dig into enough as it was happening was, what result is this going to have politically? I think a lot of people assumed that people having negative feelings about Wall Street wouldn't really have an impact on presidential politics or partisan politics in any particular way, among other things, because people associated Wall Street more with the Republican Party. But it didn't really work out that way for a variety of reasons that we're going to get into today. And I think it helped shape this dynamic of kind of us against them rhetoric across the board in politics. And we see that in both the Bernie movement and some other movements on the right. But he gets into all this. The series is great. And he'll talk a little bit more about who produced it, what the different chapters of the story are. Should be a great discussion. So
yeah,
let's get to it. All right, welcome to Useful Idiots. David Sirota, friend of show.
Welcome back.
Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
This feels a little unnatural. Like almost like ethically, I'm not even sure whether what the deal is here. I'm going to ask you about something that I know all about. Right?
I know.
I can ask instead.
So it's kind of I'm kind of full of it, right?
You're not full of it. I'm sure we can explore things that we agree or disagree on.
Right.
But yes, you are an important voice in the project that we're going to talk about for sure.
Okay. All right. Well, so tell us about Meltdown.
Tell me about this project of which I don't know as much and in which I have not participated.
Sure. So the project is called Meltdown. I've spent about 16 months reporting it. It's executive produced by me and Alex Gibney, the director, the Oscar-winning director. The basic premise is that I think a lot of people know about the financial crisis that happened. There's been a lot of amazing reporting done about that, including by Matt Taibbi, about what happened to create the financial crisis. There has been less of a willingness by people in power to look at how the aftermath of the financial crisis ended up making lots and lots of people disillusioned about the government in general, about the Democratic Party in specific. And so the Meltdown is a project that looks at the Democratic Party, its response to the financial crisis, making lots of promises in 2008, offering up lots of populist rhetoric, and even in 2009 and 2010, but essentially throwing in with Wall Street, and how that helped create the backlash conditions for Donald Trump. It helped create the backlash conditions that I think still exist in this country, where people look very skeptically at the idea that government can or is willing to do anything other than enrich the rich and empower the powerful. So that's what the series takes a look at. How did that happen? What were the promises that were made? And how did those promises end up, they were explicit, how did they end up being so unfulfilled?
Sort of starting at the very beginning, where do we first see a discrepancy between what the Democratic Party is saying about its crisis response and what it actually does? Because obviously the response starts before Barack Obama even takes office. So it's a little bit of a complicated story.
Right. Well, I mean, Obama played, let's remember, he played a really big role in forging the TARP program, in the sense that, remember, he flew back. People forget this. He flew back. It was during the end of the campaign. He came back to Washington. It was this big moment where he, McCain, and Bush were at the White House, and Obama essentially urged passage of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which was the giant bank bailout. And there was some progressive skepticism of that bailout, and there was some right-wing skepticism of that bailout. But ultimately, they managed to pass it. Actually, on the second vote, it actually went down. On its first vote, which shows that there was really skepticism there. And then he gets into office, and the first win, I mean, there was a Politico story that his first win, he was making calls, his first win was to release the second pot of money in that bailout. So, you know, he had at least partial ownership of that bailout. And what we really see is that that bailout ended up being a very top-down bailout. Even, by the way, the Obama administration officials in our series admit that it was a top-down bailout, lots of money given to a handful of financial institutions. You know, the party had been saying, we're going to deliver help to regular people, but it was a very trickle-down bailout. And where I think things really began at the start of the Obama presidency, really began to unravel, was in the whole scandal over the AIG bonuses, which was sort of a tempest in a teapot, but I think because it represented something bigger, it became a huge scandal. And the basics of that were that the Democrats were passing their stimulus bill, and they made a big thing about, hey, we're going to make sure that bailout money, at least at the minimum, isn't subsidizing the giant bonuses of the Wall Street people who created this problem. And then what we ended up finding out was, and it became a huge story, you know, Glenn Beck and all these folks, you know, fanned the flames of it. The Republicans pretended to be all upset about it, that the Democrats had slipped in language into their own stimulus bill, basically saying that AIG, which was one of the central players in the financial crisis, that AIG could use the money, you know, tens of billions of dollars that it had been given. It could use some of that money to pay executive bonuses. So what ended up happening was, 3 months after the election, the Republicans, who had just gotten their asses kicked, they got themselves a political bailout. I mean, they got to stand up there and say, hey, you know, this is, you know, why is the Obama administration going to bat for AIG? And look, at AIG gives money to some of these Democrats who orchestrated this, people like Senator Chris Dodd. So that was the first sign that the Democrats were not necessarily serious about fulfilling their promises. And Obama was like flailing around. I mean, at first he said, I'm so mad about this. How could this happen? And then ultimately he went on 60 Minutes and said, you know, there's nothing we can really do. So it was a little, not even little. I mean, it was a real moment where I think it was the first time, and it was early on, where it was like, you just campaigned across the country saying you're going to get tough on these people. And right out of the gate, you're allowing bailout money to be used to subsidize executive bonuses. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, money to capitalize the banks, money, literally bonuses for the people who created the crisis.
Yeah, not just AIG, right. AIG FP, mm-hmm. which most people don't know, was a little tiny. So AIG is an insurance company, but they had a financial products division that mostly worked out of London. They had an office in Connecticut as well. But these guys were basically sort of the bookies for Wall Street. A lot of people who were buying what they call credit protection against the possibility of subprime mortgages collapsing were basically taking out that insurance with this little tiny company, which had irresponsibly sold, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of these policies. And that was one of the things that triggered the crash. And it was exactly those guys who got bailed out, right? And so that was a talking point that the Republicans got really early on, was, you know, not just Wall Street generally, but like specifically the patient zero of the crisis.
Right. Exactly. And I just think, like, you know, from there, it could have been an isolated incident. It could have been like, look, we screwed up. We put this thing in. We didn't realize the timing of it. But the problem was, it was the beginning of something. That what happened moving forward was that you know, ultimately what unfolded is the Democrats didn't prosecute any of these people. The Dodd-Frank bill was watered down. There was a very explicit promise, and we talk about this. This is the one that kind of blows my mind, was the whole situation over something called cram down. I don't know if people remember this. There, Obama on the campaign trail made this very explicit promise, and he kind of got all into it. He got like populist about it. He said, you know, there's this quote, he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, you know, it doesn't seem to me that it's fair that, you know, millionaires and billionaires can get bankruptcy protection on their second home, their third home, their fourth home, their yachts, but people who are in their first home, who are now underwater on their mortgages, they can't get any kind of bankruptcy protection from lenders, from the big banks. This seems ridiculous. We got to change the bankruptcy laws. And I, you know, obviously that makes a whole lot of sense. And there was so he made an explicit promise, and he's right. In our laws, and this is kind of mind blowing, but in our laws, our bankruptcy laws still today say that bankruptcy judges, if you walk into bankruptcy court and you say, hey, listen, I can't pay my bills, the bankruptcy judge can take a look at all your debts, and the bankruptcy judge is not allowed to shield you from the debts on your primary residence. It's an incredible problem, but it can shield you on other things, and it can shield millionaires and billionaires credit. On other things. Yeah, exactly. And worth adding, this problem was exacerbated, by the way, by Joe Biden, that the bankruptcy bill of 2005 that he pushed forward on behalf of the credit card companies made sure that credit card companies are supposed to be paid back first before you even pay back your mortgages. So there was a Fed study that said that bill actually increased foreclosures because people had to pay back their credit card debt first before they paid their home mortgage payments, which meant that people, ultimately, lots of people got foreclosed on. So Obama goes into the presidency promising to fix some of this, promising to say, hey, listen, we're going to pass a little bill to let judges write down people's mortgages, right? So you bought a house for 200 grand. You lost your job in the middle of this crisis. Your house isn't worth 200 grand anymore. Let's say it's now worth, because the housing market collapsed, now worth 175 grand. The judge can say, hey, listen, banks, the loan gets written down to what the property now is. You got to have some skin in the game here. It goes down to 175, 150, makes it easier for the person to pay their mortgages. Obama promised that bill, and ultimately his administration helped kill it. That was the reporting from members of Congress. They just didn't want to take on the banks, because obviously the loser in that situation, or at least some of the loser, is the bank. The bank doesn't get to foreclose on your home. The bank has to take a little bit of a loss. And they just didn't want to allow the banks to take any losses. And there's this quote that Neil Barofsky, the head of the TARP program, basically the inspector general, the guy who's supposed to police this. He said at one point he was in a meeting with Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, who said, and he was lecturing Barofsky and Elizabeth Warren, who was then one of the people policing the bailout, said, listen, you don't get it. The bailout, all of these policies, they're designed to foam the runway for the banks. That was the sort of phrase, foam the runway, that essentially human beings, people in their homes, were the foam on the runway so that the banks could land comfortably. And so, these stories are kind of shocking and horrifying, but our point is that it's not just about the history, that this is exactly the kind of politics and betrayal that harmed millions of people. And guess what? That anger, that feeling of frustration, ended up having a political expression in the political arena. And I want to be clear, I'm not saying I think like Donald Trump deserved to win, or the Tea Party was being honest about its being outraged about these things, or Republican politicians being out, like that was all a farce. It was all opportunistic. And the point is that if you do not deliver for people, then guess what? There's an opportunist waiting around the corner to try to seize power and seize on your failings.
How does that relate to what's happening today?
I think there's a direct line, right? I mean, the Democrats got elected promising, I'm talking about 2016 now, promising to help people, promising various programs to have, you know, directly help people. Sorry, it's 2020. I'm getting confused. Yeah, 2020, right? We're going to help people. We got to get Donald Trump out of here because he's not helping people. We're going to help people, right? And what you've seen, and by the way, at the beginning of Biden's presidency, I think he actually sort of, some synapse in his brain, I think he sort of got that. He's like, I got to get, you know, he promised $2,000. It was only $1,400, but at least it was like, we got to get help out to people. And guess what? That was popular. It's a popular thing. You know, I'm just helping people, right? Not a top-down bailout. His first rescue bill was a good first step. The child tax credit helped lots of people. But now in the reconciliation debate over the anti-poverty, the healthcare programs, the housing programs, you see this horrible process where the Democratic Party is backing away from its explicit most popular proposals. I mean, here's a mind-blowing thing. There was a Politico story that kind of, it didn't shock me, but it's kind of like mind-blowing. There was a Politico story, again, paraphrasing, but it was like, Democrats are now looking to get rid of, water down or excise their drug pricing provisions in order to get a final deal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you start thinking about it, you're like, so in order to get a final deal with your own party, you're going to cut out the thing that in polls, the one thing in polls that people say they most want, like literally that in polls, allow Medicare to negotiate lower prices, is the number one polling thing initiative about the reconciliation bill. The number one thing that people say they want in order for the party to get a deal on legislation, a deal with its own party. Apparently, it has to cut out the thing that's the thing that people most want. It relates directly to this. And, you know, we wrote today in a Rolling Stone piece that we have to understand that this connects to the crisis of democracy. This is not just a situation that is about the economy. I mean, obviously, the healthcare system is horrible. Obviously, drug companies are ripping people off. Obviously, you know, the economy has become a kind of neo-feudal economy. Those are all, that's all obvious. I think what's less obvious, but really important, is that if people keep voting for change, and you, the Democratic Party, keep promising change, and then you get into power, and you shill for your corporate donors who don't want that change, and you choose your corporate donors, and you betray your promises to voters, what you're saying to voters is that democracy doesn't matter. And so if you do that, if you gut that agenda, and then you think you're going to run for re-election or in a midterm election saying, hey, you know, maybe you're mad about our betrayals, maybe you don't like that, but we got to protect democracy, right? We got to protect democracy from the insurrectionists and the like. There's going to be a lot of voters who say, look, I just voted for you. I just used democracy to put you in power. Your defense of democracy, you're saying I gotta support you only because of democracy. You're proving to me that democracy doesn't matter. So that sending that message over and over and over again is part of the crisis of democracy. And look, I want to be clear. I mean, it should be obvious. I'm not saying I think it's great that the Republicans are trying to limit voting rights and, you know, sort of are, you know, rejecting, denying election results. But the point is that arguments about that become less politically salient when the party in power is essentially saying to voters, you voted for us, we promised you things to get you to vote for us, and we're not going to deliver for you.
I mean, I obviously agree with all that. I remember in 2010 being at a foreclosure court, you know, it's like a line of people being evicted in these high speed foreclosures. They call them rocket dockets right at the time. And this was happening sort of before Occupy Wall Street.
Right.
And they're completely different people. So the people who are being foreclosed on are sort of ordinary middle-class people of all races, you know, white, black, Latino, everything, but they're not the Occupy people, right? They're not college-educated intellectual protesters. When did those people, it felt to me like if that energy ever got directed somewhere, because there was so much rage in that room, it was going to be very powerful. Is what you're saying essentially that the Democrats lost the opportunity to talk to those people?
Exactly.
You know, with, I mean, their, I think with their pulse.
Exactly. And I, for everyone watching, Matt is in our series, specifically in one episode about that situation in Florida, which was, you know, exemplified a larger situation. And it's incredibly powerful. I mean, your reporting on that was just incredibly powerful, and how it was all happening in these kind of dark, you know, dungeons that nobody was paying attention to. And, you know, it was just this horrible process. And yes, the Democrats had an opportunity to take that justifiable frustration and anger and channel it into something real and positive. And, you know, I think we have to understand that that's not some sort of crazy idea, that's exactly what Franklin Roosevelt did. And I know, you know, I know referring back to the New Deal and Roosevelt is a cliche, but what's really interesting about the New Deal, and if you look at what Roosevelt was saying, he actually understood this connection between economic policy, people's frustration, and democracy in a very explicit way. And he said, essentially, at one point on his campaign, millions of people will not stand silently by when the things to provide their needs are available but not being provided. That's a paraphrase. He said it much more eloquently than me, right? He also said that in other countries, other industrialized countries, democracy was on the ropes because people were frustrated with inept government, essentially corrupt government, and ultimately they were willing to sacrifice democracy in order to get something to eat. That was the point in saying that was what he was saying was the New Deal, to actually invest in people, to actually help people, to actually have, if you're going to do a bailout, a bottom-up bailout, that one of the reasons to do that, beyond it being the moral thing to do, beyond it being the necessary thing to do, is that's a way to combat fascism, essentially. That's the way, so that when the right-wing opportunist comes along and says, hey, look, you know, you're getting screwed by the banks, you're getting screwed by the rocket docket, you're getting screwed by all these things, and the party in power doesn't care about you, doing something robust and real like the New Deal is a way to channel that justifiable frustration in a positive direction. And the Democrats they did that to win power in 2008, but they did not do that in government. It's easy to campaign on that stuff. It's harder. And you know, it's funny, when Alex Gibney and I were writing this piece for Rolling Stone, which talks about the project, he at one point he said to me, you know, I forgot how big a majority did the Democrats have in Congress when Obama, he's like, I forgot how big, he's like, well, was it a pretty slim majority? I was like, dude, they had 59 Senate votes. Arguably they had 60 Senate votes, right? I think people have just forgotten how much power that the Democratic Party had. Now you can argue, look, well, yeah, they may have 60 votes, but they had Joe Lieberman and they had, you know, Ben Nelson and the sort of rotating villain that we now see in Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. There's always like somebody, one or two people, who it's always their fault and not the Democratic Party's fault. But the point is, it is the party. The president has the power. Barack Obama was a wildly popular president when he first came in, had a huge mandate. So the idea that like the rotating villain is the reason why the party couldn't do something real to help homeowners, to channel that anger that you reported on in Florida, for instance. The idea that it was, oh, you know, Ben Nelson is the reason why we couldn't do anything. I mean, that's a bunch of crap. That's just a bunch of crap.
Well, we hope it ends up getting the attention that it needs.
Well, I really appreciate you guys having me on to talk about it. Because here's the thing. It's not like there's like a ton of corporate media folks knocking down my door to want to talk about this, but I hope it gets through. I really do. And I really want to say it really was an earnest project to try to sound the alarm. It was a lot of reporting. It was a ton of work. It was a huge slog. Anybody who tells you that these reported podcasts are kind of easy or whatever, I mean, you know, Matt, you've done these kind of long term, it just takes a ton of work, and it's all just to try to kind of sound the alarm.
Yeah. I think it, you know, it's really, really well done. Highly recommend that everybody check it out. And it's very needed, also very timely, considering, you know, the reconciliation bill the lead up to 2022. I mean, there's a lot of decisions in this area that are being made right now. I think this kind of speaks to if people get it, you know. So let's hope they do. But
you can find it.
It's at Audible. That's right. It's on Audible. Just search Meltdown. You'll find it. You'll find it. And by the way, but one last thing just to add. One of the most, I just want to give people a preview. There's two previews. One, there's a never before aired interview between me and Barack Obama at the end, which I think people will find very interesting.
Wow.
Yes.
When is it from? When was it done?
It is from 2006. I got a call from Barack Obama, who was mad that I had criticized him about something. And I then went and spent a day with him. And so the audio from that day, there's pieces of audio in there.
Wow.
Enjoy that. And there's also, I'm just going to leave you with this. There's also this, it still boggles the mind. There is a audio quote of something that Chuck Schumer said right before the 2016 election that is so unbelievably tone deaf and so unbelievably insane, just now in retrospect, that you just have to hear it. Because it's such a perfect encapsulation of how out of touch the party was to what was going on. That's all I'm going to say. Because I've listened to it so many times. Like, I cannot believe he literally said this with a smile, and he was smug and excited and sort of proud of this, and how ridiculous it sounds in retrospect.
All right, now we got to go out and listen to it right now. So excellent. Well, that's great. It's like the old joke, how do you keep an idiot in suspense? I'll tell you tomorrow. But David, this has been great talking about this.
So
really glad that this has finally come out, and good luck on everything. And we'll check in with you again soon.
Great. Thanks to both of you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com. That was great.
It was great.
Yeah.
Daily
Poster is an amazing publication.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely recommend it. Follow David if you're on Twitter at David Sirota. Go to dailyposter.com. They do really good reporting.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is a project that's been near and dear to his heart for a long time.
Yeah.
It's interesting because, you know, obviously he has that connection to Bernie.
Right.
The Sanders campaign in 2016 was really, in a lot of ways, like an implicit criticism of the Democratic response to the crash. And he never really came out and said it like that way. I think the idea was to try to drive people to realize some of the things that David's talking about in this, that they're talking about in Meltdown. And while they raised a lot of awareness, the frustration is there's still this reluctance to realize that, and it's going to continue to have political consequences. So let's hope it ends up having the effect that he wants.
Yeah.
All right. So we will see you again on Monday.
Monday morning, MOURNING edition of Useful Idiots, where we respond to Sunday's morning shows.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Make sure you subscribe to youtube.com/usefulidiots so you don't miss those. Also, make sure you become supporters of our Substack, usefulidiots.substack.com, so you get great bonus content. Rate and review us on iTunes.
Yes.
Do you want to say a little thing about how we're going to donate a portion of...
Yeah, so just FYI for those of you who might not know... We're in the process. I'm going to announce this more formally next week. We made a deal with the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press to donate a pretty substantial portion of the earnings of this show to that organization. So, and most of that money is going to go towards things like legal defense for reporters who are in trouble, people who are being sued, people who need legal advice, who aren't big corporate lawyers. So it's a way to help alternative media exist and compete and do all those things. And so we're trying to take some of the support that you've given us and give it back to people in the business.
Right. Yes. And if you don't want to hear the ads, that's another upside.
Right. Or yeah.
I shouldn't say that. If you're for whatever reason don't like hearing ads, you can become the Substack people get to hear the show free of ads.
Right, right. And if you might be wondering why it is that that you're hearing ads, this is part of the thinking. Yeah. But anyway, we will see you next week on the Monday morning, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Bye.
All right.
Hello. Thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday Morning Show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.
The Bigger Pockets portfolio of podcasts are worthy of your investment.
We're having a real conversation as real estate investors.
New episodes available every day.
It's important to buy where it makes money and not necessarily where you want to travel to.
Bigger Pockets, On the Market, Rookie Real Estate, or Money Podcast.
The purpose of flipping is to create more cash so then you can reinvest into other types of properties.
The Bigger Pockets podcast on YouTube or wherever you listen.